Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. Scientific research needs supporting infrastructure. Some of it's small, some of it's very big, but rarely is it simple. The Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, or DUNE, will explore the properties of the neutrino, among the smallest atomic particles, yet a fundamental building block of the universe. DUNE involves sending neutrinos generated at the Long Baseline Neutrino Facility in Illinois, 800 miles underground to South Dakota, where a massive particle detector 1,500 meters underground will capture data for use by scientists around the world. To help us understand the experiment itself and the infrastructure that will make it possible and how that infrastructure is being built, we've invited Ron Ray, who's a particle physicist at Fermilab in suburban Chicago and deputy project director of the LBNF DUNE project team, to join us. Ron earned his PhD in particle physics from the University of California, Irvine, and he worked as a scientific researcher at Northwestern University. Ron, I'm very happy to talk to you today and ask you to explain this experiment to us.
Sure. So I'm happy to be here. And so the experiment is designed around the unique properties of neutrinos. And so neutrinos, as you mentioned, are fascinating particles. They're fundamental particles. They're neutral. They have no charge. They have very small masses, and they interact very weakly. And the fact that they interact very weakly has an important impact on the infrastructure. But just so people understand the importance of neutrinos, they're the most abundant particles in the universe besides photons. About 100 trillion of them pass through you every second. And something that I find very fascinating, about 15 million of those that are passing through you every second are relics from the Big Bang, which is pretty interesting to think about. And so even though neutrinos have very small mass and they interact very weakly, they have a significant impact on the large-scale structure of the universe. They're a potential dark matter candidate. They play important roles in nuclear physics processes, and they play an important role in stellar collapse, you know, so the formation of neutron stars and black holes. But also importantly, neutrinos play a role in the matter dominance of the universe, you know, why we live in a matter-dominated universe instead of one made up of equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And so one of the things that I like to say is that if you want to understand the universe, you have to understand neutrinos. Now, there's another, so neutrinos are also, quite interestingly, a quantum physics laboratory. And so this is getting to what DUNE is really all about. And so there are three types of neutrinos that we know about, and they have the ability to change or oscillate, as we say, from one type to another. And so one of DUNE's primary goals is to make the world's most precise measurements of the oscillation parameters for both neutrinos and antineutrinos. And it's very important that we can do both. And if those oscillation parameters are different, it would be the second example of nature differentiating between matter and antimatter. And
what's the first?
So quarks also do this. And so we see this in kaon decays and B decays, where matter and antimatter behave slightly differently. We refer to it as CP violation, which is a physics, you know, the way physicists talk, but it's really a difference in the way that matter and antimatter behave. So it happens at the quark level, and we're interested to see whether it happens with neutrinos. And so DUNE can measure this very accurately. It turns out that, you know, there are three neutrinos, and we know they have mass, and they're very light, but we don't know which neutrino is the lightest and which is the heaviest. And we refer to this as the neutrino mass ordering or the neutrino mass hierarchy. And DUNE can determine the mass ordering of the neutrinos, and that's part of the reason why the baseline, the distance, is so long, is because it makes it easier for us to measure that. DUNE can also see neutrinos from supernova if we're lucky enough to have one go off, and those neutrinos and antineutrinos from supernova carry important information about the physics of stellar collapse. And DUNE can also search for new physics, you know, deviations from the standard model. And so, and Dune can do this all in one single experiment. And so we're all the neutrino world is really looking forward to when we're ready to execute this experiment. But first, we have to build the infrastructure that can support the experiment, and then we have to build the experiment.
So, but understanding the experiment is what drives the design of the infrastructure.
Absolutely. And so the property of neutrinos that's most important if you want to study them is the fact that they interact very weakly. And so that drives the scale of the experiment. So everything has to be massive. So in order to make precision measurements of neutrinos, first you have to make a lot of them. And so one of the things we do here at Fermilab is to make particle beams. And so in order to make a very intense beam of neutrinos, we have to start with a 2-megawatt proton beam. Okay, and so 2 megawatts is a very, we've almost gotten to 1 megawatt proton beams here so far. And so in order to be ready to do Dune, we have to get to 2 megawatts eventually.
So is that what the Long Baseline Neutrino facility is going to do?
So part of the LBNF facility is to build the beam line that will produce the neutrino beam that will be pointed towards South Dakota. And so that is part of the project, is to produce this 2-megawatt proton beam that will then produce the world's most intense beams of both neutrinos and antineutrinos. So Fermilab is an accelerator laboratory. This is something that we know how to do, but we've never built a 2-megawatt beam before.
So you're at 1 megawatt now, though, you said.
That's right.
So what does it take to go from 1 to 2? Is there an infrastructure requirement? Is there a power requirement?
The real challenge is building a target that can last for a year or so. And so a target that can absorb that much energy without degrading quickly is really part of the challenge. So we've developed a graphite target that's cooled using helium gas.
And that's on site at the LBNF?
That will be on site at Fermilab. So that's part of the LBNF beamline that we're building here at Fermilab.
Okay. All right. So I get it. So it's a materials question then designing that target.
It really is, yes.
Okay, and then explain again to why 800 miles? Why does it have to be so far away, the collector?
Right, so that's a very good question. And so the oscillation probability of neutrinos goes as L over E, where L is the distance, it's the 800 miles, and E is the energy of the neutrinos, which in our case ranges from about 1 to 5 GeV. And so that distance puts us at a place where the oscillation effects are maximal. And so it will allow us to see actually the first two oscillation maxima. So it puts us at a place where the effect is the largest, and that makes it easier for us to make precision measurements of the parameters that drive the oscillation.
So was there some magic that led you to this Sanford facility in South Dakota, or was it just there?
It was just there, and it happened to be at about the right place.
Okay. And my understanding is it was an underground mine.
At one time, it was owned by Barrick Gold, and it was an active gold mine going back, over 100 years. But for the last couple of decades, it's been used as a physics lab, as a deep underground physics mm-hmm. laboratory.
What's the significance of it being 1,500 meters below the surface?
So the being underground provides shielding from cosmic rays. Because cosmic rays can do things in your detector that might look like neutrino interactions. And so the easiest way to deal with that is just to shield them so that you eliminate most of them.
So my thinking about geometry is if you orient the beam coming out of neutrinos coming out of the LBNF properly, that you can hit that 1,500 meters below the surface at 800-mile distance.
That's right. And so the beam is pitched down by about 5 degrees, 5 or 6 degrees, because the neutrino beam has to pass through the Earth. And again, this takes advantage of the properties of neutrinos that they interact very weakly. And so most of the neutrinos that leave Fermilab will arrive in South Dakota, And then a small fraction of those neutrinos that arrive in South Dakota will interact in the massive detectors that we're building there. Again, that's one of the reason we have to build detectors that are so large is because so few of the neutrinos will interact. And so the more mass you have, the more.
So scale is critical to this experiment.
Scale is absolutely essential to this experiment, and that's why everything has to be so big. And you know, size, you know, equates to dollars, and so this is big, you know, big expensive science.
And jumping ahead, my assumption is, from what you've already told us, there are lots of questions that you should be able to answer with the Dune experiment. So it should have a long lifetime.
Absolutely. So we once the facility and the experiment are built, we will likely run for 20, maybe 30 years.
And my understanding is there's competition out there. There are other labs around the world that are trying to understand neutrinos.
There is competition everywhere. There's another long baseline neutrino oscillation experiment in Japan. But their baseline is shorter than ours, and they're using older technology. But they're experienced physicists who know what they're doing, and so they're definitely competition. You can also do neutrino experiments using neutrinos from reactors, and so there are reactor experiments as well. The benefit that Dune has is that we can measure everything in one experiment. The neutrino the reactor experiments can only measure a couple of things. The experiment in Japan, because their baseline is short, can only measure some of the things that are interesting. Dune can do it all. And so that's one of the reasons why we say that Dune will be the best-in-class long baseline neutrino experiment. But we do have competition, and we always, you know, we compete, but we cooperate as well, because in the end, what matters is the science.
Yeah. So tell us about the detector. My understanding is what you're looking for is collisions between neutrinos and other particles in this very large detector.
Right. So the detectors that we're building are called liquid argon time projection chambers. And so these are massive detectors. Eventually there will be four of these detectors, and the detectors each hold 17,000 tons of liquid argon cooled to, you know, minus 184 degrees C.
Why does it have to be cooled?
So that the argon is liquid.
And why does it have to be liquid?
Because you need it to be dense.
To maximize the chance of a collision.
That's right.
Got it.
And so each of these detectors is a little over 200 feet long, 50 feet wide, and 46 feet high. So it's the size of a five-story building. And eventually there will be four of them. And so the liquid argon time projection chambers is, I like to refer to it as 21st century neutrino detection technology to differentiate it from water Cherenkov detectors that have been around for a very long time, but still do a very good job. But the benefit of the detectors that we're building is that you can literally see the neutrino interactions and you can see the tracks. It's like an old bubble chamber picture.
Mm. So you're looking for light? Is that what you're trying to detect?
So what happens is that the neutrino interacts on an argon nucleus, mm-hmm. and if it's an electron neutrino, it will produce an electron track, and so that electron track, it passes through the argon and it ionizes argon atoms, and then the electrons from that argon, the electrons from the argon atoms that are ionized, they drift because there's an electric field applied across this entire detector, and so they drift up or down towards the cathodes or anodes, and that generates an electrical signal that allows us to see the track as it passes through. At the same time, those particles create scintillation light. And so we actually have two detection mechanisms, and we can see the ionization, but we can also see the light. So it's both.
And then the analysis comes from looking at the tracks of the particles that result or the from the collisions.
That's exactly right.
I'm not sure you can say this in a simple way, but how do you collect and detect that information? I get it that you measure the light and you measure the ionization, but somehow that's collected and sent to an analysis activity.
Right. So there's thousands of wires and thousands of sensors and hundreds of light collection devices, you know, silicon photomultiplier tubes. And, you know, depending on where the track is in the detector, they light up and they have signals associated with them. And so that all gets recorded. We used to record it on tape. Now we recorded them on discs. And we will record a massive amount of data, and that will get distributed around the world. And scientists from around the world will, you know, unpack this data and, you know, reconstruct it into tracks and analyze it.
So I want to take you back to the detector in South Dakota. Your knowledge of the physics defined the design, defined the scale and the materials to maximize the chance that you'll get the information that you want from the experiment. Is that a correct description?
Yes, absolutely.
So you're a particle physicist. How did you get into the design, or how do particle physicists get into the design of experimental infrastructure?
That's a good question. It wasn't by design.
Well, you didn't learn this in graduate school.
No, I did not. You know, I started out in my career building particle detectors and doing Monte Carlo simulations and analyzing data. And eventually, as your career progresses, you do more management stuff than you do science. And eventually, you end up, you know, managing large projects like this. But no, I don't think any scientist plans for their career to go that way.
It's a characteristic of big science that you have to build the machine, you have to build the equipment, or somebody has to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is a perfect example of big science. There are 1,400 scientists from around the world working on this. 35 countries, including CERN. And so this is big, you know, international science, you know, but Fermilab is the host laboratory, we really bear the brunt of the responsibility for building the infrastructure. So one of the things that I haven't mentioned yet, but which is really fascinating and which really goes to the heart of the infrastructure, is that these large detectors have to sit in large caverns that are a mile underground. And those caverns didn't exist. And we've just recently completed excavating them. And so excavating caverns a mile underground, there's nothing simple about that. And so we've excavated an entire campus a mile underground that's about the size of 8 soccer fields. We've excavated, you know, over 800,000 tons of rock that we had to move to the surface and dispose of. And so that's the equivalent weight of about 8 aircraft carriers. And we've poured about 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of concrete. We used about 560 tons of explosives, you know, in order to create these caverns. It was just a massive undertaking. And the thing about working a mile underground is that you have to get a mile underground. And at this facility, there's only 2 ways to get underground. There's two shafts. They're basically freight elevators, if you will. And so everything that goes underground has to go through these shafts. And, you know, the shafts are basically, you know, 5 feet by 12 feet by 12 feet high. And if something's too long to fit in the cage that runs through the shaft, then you have to sling it below the shaft. And so all of the heavy equipment that we had to get underground, all these big trucks and things that were necessary to get underground to build these caverns, basically had to be taken apart, slung underneath the cage that runs through the shaft, taken a mile underground, and then put back together underground. And so, you know,
what powers these? Are you using diesel equipment underground?
We're using diesel equipment underground. And so one of the, you know, features of this infrastructure is that there has to be a significant amount of ventilation.
Yeah. And when it's in full use, I assume the ventilation requirements go down substantially.
We had to get a variance from OSHA because, you know, the ventilation requirements underground in tunnels underground is different than in a laboratory at the surface. You know, the air basically comes down through the shafts and then goes out through another shaft. And if in order to have the airflow at the exit, that would be required, the airflow at the entrance would have to be like, you know, a small hurricane or something. And so we had to get a variance to adjust some of those rules. But in the end, we were able to work safely.
So I want to take you back to the design. My assumption, I'm not trying to take away credit from you. My assumption is you didn't do the structural design. It was a collaboration between you as the, in effect, the customer and some engineers who apparently knew how to design this.
Oh, no, that's absolutely right. So we hired an engineering firm that had experience working underground, and they did the design. And then we hired a company that that had experience doing, you know, underground excavation to actually do the excavation for us. And like I say, they just recently finished. They did a great job. And not only that, but they did it safely. You know, they the company that we hired worked over 1 million man hours without a lost time incident, which is, you know, given the nature of this work, is yeah, really impressive.
I'm just curious what the experience was like. Presumably, you understand the science, you know what you need functionally in terms of a detector. That information needs to transfer over to somebody who can do the structural design.
Right. So we had very specific, you know, requirements and specifications for the size of the caverns, and, you know, the stability of the ground and the stability of the archways. And so one of the ways that they ensure stability for these underground structures is that they use these things called rock bolts, which are just what it sounds like. They're giant bolts that can be many meters long that they drill into the surface in order to help support the caverns. But yeah, I mean, this is not something that particle physicists know about. And so we hired, you know, engineering firms who had the relevant experience. And there's a whole lot that goes into this that that I never appreciated. You know, I know more about this stuff now than I ever thought I wanted to.
It's really interesting for me to think through what this collaboration was like and how the information moved back and forth of this is what you need functionally and this is what the engineers can deliver and how do you balance that to get the product that you need.
There's a lot of back and forth, and I would describe it as a bootstrap. You know, you kind of start with an idea, and then, you know, the detector folks say no, it has to be, you know, a little different, and so so there's a lot of back and forth. And so one of the absolute keys to running large projects and large collaborations is communication, and it's not a, and you know, when you've got 35 countries involved, you know, and dozens of subcontractors, and you know, none of that's easy. And so, you know, building big infrastructure, one of the keys is communication.
So how long do we have to wait until you turn this on?
So as I mentioned, we just completed the caverns, and so now we're moving into, now we have to outfit the caverns. We have to, you know, put in, you know, electricity and HVAC and plumbing and all of that stuff. And then we start, about a year from now, we start building the actual detectors. And so we expect the first detector to be online in 2029. So the first detector will be built and will be filled with liquid argon in 2029. It takes about 9 months just to fill these detectors with liquid argon.
Is sourcing liquid argon an issue or is it plentiful?
It's plentiful. It's easier to get it in the U.S. than it is to get it in Europe, it turns out. But so we have not had a problem with that. But so in 2029, we'll have a filled detector that will be able to, you know, that will be sensitive to supernova and various atmospheric neutrinos. The beamline won't be ready until 2031. And by 2031, we'll have two FAR detectors and the high power beam, and then we're really ready to go. So by 2031, we'll really begin our core physics studies.
My sense is that the beamline seems like it's a smaller piece of the puzzle. Why is it trailing?
It's funding. And so we made a decision, you know, several years ago to focus the funding that we had on the FAR site to get going there. And so the FAR site has been proceeding in what we refer to as a technically limited fashion. It's going as fast as it can, you know, based on technical considerations, because we focused our funding there. The work at Fermilab on the facility at Fermilab is funding limited. And so we're waiting to accumulate the funding. And so we just put out requests for proposals for the civil work that has to happen here at Fermilab. Which is not trivial, by the way. The near site work that we have to do here, there's two separate large construction packages. We'll end up moving about 1 million cubic yards of soil and rock, and pour about 100,000 cubic yards of concrete in order to build this beam line that's pitched downwards towards South Dakota. And then there's also another smaller enclosure where we have another detector. There's a detector on site that we call the NEAR detector that samples the neutrino beam before it heads off towards South Dakota. So in order to do the experiment, we measure neutrinos at Fermilab right after the neutrinos have been made, and then we measure them 800 miles later in South
Dakota. Yeah, presumably you need to know what you're sending out is, and compare that to what you're catching at the other end.
Exactly, yes.
It's a massive project. It's a huge project, and you have a long way to go. You've got 5 years before you get that first detector up and running.
Yes, and so patience is a virtue in this.
I guess. Has this been a good project for you? I mean, that's a setup question. You can only give me one answer, but it would seem like it's very exciting to be a part of such a large experiment.
It is extremely exciting, but it's the largest project in the Department of Energy Office of Science, but that also means there's a very bright light shining.
Oh, my. Yeah. In this day and age, that's a challenge. But it sounds like overall the construction end, the design and construction is working as planned.
Yes, we're very happy. I'm very, very proud of the work that we've done so far on the infrastructure in South Dakota. The cavern work really went quite well, very few hiccups. If the rest of the project goes as smoothly as the excavation did, we will all be very happy.
Well, it's a very impressive project, and I really appreciate your spending the time explaining it to us. I'm not sure that I would be fully qualified to explain it to another person, but I feel I understand it much better now than I did before this conversation started. So thanks for telling us about this. We'll try to keep an eye on it. We wish you the very best and look forward to reading about results.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff, so it's been fun.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I'm Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.